Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to this bumper jam-packed Review of the Year podcast special. The year in question, of course, being 2017. And the review being of the cinematic year, not the actual year itself, which I think we can all agree was a horrifying shit show. But onwards, we blindly stumble. And here to join me over the next 90 minutes or so to discuss the cinematic year, our three colleagues of such lethal cunning, Nick Desimlian.
Hello.
James Dyer.
Hi.
And Helen O'Hara.
Hey up.
How are you all?
Yeah.
That's good. It's good. We're off to a good start.
Yeah.
Let's rate the year out of 10.
1.
Why?
Trump.
Okay. Helen?
I mean, it would be a 1 because of Brexit, but I'm giving it 3 because of, you know, Hamilton, I guess.
Does every year get at least 3 because of Hamilton?
Yeah.
Just adds 3 to every year. I'll go in between 2. It's not been good, has it?
I might give it an extra half a mark because Aaron Sorkin had his directorial debut. So, you know,
that's
only a half. I'm telling him.
Yeah, the 4-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game. I think we can all agree.
Isn't that out in January in this country?
Exactly.
Yeah, Deadly Beginners next year.
Well, yeah, but I've seen it and that has made my year at least half a point better.
Let's not get bogged down in talk about real world and politics and whatnot. Let's get on with the films. We're going to split this into 2 parts, this podcast, over the next 90 minutes or so. So the first half will be us discussing readers' questions. So you've sent in some questions and some suggestions for categories that we can discuss about the year in question. And then the second part of the year, we're going to be counting down Empire's top 20 films of the year. And we will be discussing whether we think we got it right.
So, I have notes.
I have a couple of notes as well. But it's a democratic process.
It is.
You can't argue with it.
You can.
So, let's get on with the questions. All right, so me being me, I wrote down the questions, but I didn't write down the people who wrote the questions.
Super good.
So, while we're trying to do that, while you're talking about them, I will try and find the names. But the first one is, what was your guilty pleasure film of the year?
Never feel guilty about pleasure, darling.
Well, quite. It's tricky, isn't it, to isolate? Because by guilty pleasure kind of implies a bad film that you enjoyed.
I mean, there was a Fast and Furious film this year.
I mean,
which is as close as one comes to a guilty pleasure.
It kind of is, isn't it? Mm. That's pretty much a guilty pleasure,
but
I would say.
I thought it was a bad Fast and Furious film, and it wasn't as pleasurable. It was more guilty pleasurable,
yeah.
I would say, than the previous.
It had a submarine.
3.
It did, coming through the ice.
This is 8, right?
This is eight.
It also had the fate of the Furious.
I got a lot guilt and pleasure from the Rock versus Staith prison fight. That ticks my boxes.
That was good.
Yeah. Although the Staith turning good just upset me in a lot of ways.
That's incredible retconning.
It was massive retconning.
We should say at this point, by the way, this is a Review of the Year podcast, and we're going to be going full spoiler on a lot of the stuff that happened in a lot of the films this year.
Yeah, we'll be considerate of very recent
stuff.
What
I will say is we should have a rule whereby if we're going to spoil a film, we mention the name of the film, and then if people are listening to this on their phone, they can press the 15 seconds forward skip and just move forward a little bit, thereby avoiding said spoiler.
Like we're going to be able to compress that into 15 seconds.
Let's try.
You're very optimistic.
Maybe press it a couple of times just to be on the
same
side.
Very optimistic. That was a good fight. And there were things I enjoyed about Fast and Furious 8. And why are we talking about this as the first movie?
I think we should do a spoiler special.
I would probably class... I mean, I feel guilty even suggesting John Wick 2 is a guilty pleasure.
It's not.
I think it's an epically good film.
It's a pleasure.
But I think the pleasure I get from it is guilty because it's just watching him massacre people is kind of a guilty pleasure. Do you know what I mean? In the same way that, like, when you watch Taken, you're just like, yes, God, I wish I was you. You know, it has that. Like, I want to be John Wick.
Is that what you see, James, when you close your eyes? It's just Keanu Reeves slaying people.
Well, you know, in The Office, when we're talking and you just see me drift away for a second after you've annoyed me, what I'm envisioning is a lot of what happens in the third act of John Wick 2.
A lot of gun-fu.
Yeah.
What about Valerian?
Neither, I
had to look up the title, even though I covered this film for the magazine, and the City of a Thousand Planets.
Luke
not
Besson,
the Planet of a Thousand Cities.
Luke Besson is guilty. We had no pleasure.
No, there was pleasure to be had, just not as much of it as there should have been. That was the thing for me.
I like a CG-heavy film about little cute dinosaurs that ship magic pearls as much as the next person, but that particular one, I think, wasn't the best in that specific subgenre.
I thought there were some great sequences in that, though. I thought the bit with the big weird alien king when there's a big banquet and everyone's bringing in food, and that was fun.
That's demented. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That I really felt like that. A weird experimental sort of Belgian animation.
Yeah. Arguably, The Mummy. I didn't dislike The Mummy. I know a lot of people do, and I can absolutely 100% see why. Yeah. But but Tom Cruise was working so hard to be entertaining that I was entertained.
I remember James, Chris and myself sitting in a wasabi in a train station. Post Mummy, and shaking our heads. I don't think there was even much conversation. It was just. Tom Cruise was not the problem with the film.
No, he was not. No,
but there were problems.
There were problems.
I would say he was the best thing in it by a country mile.
Yes, he was.
On sheer charisma, he stopped me from gouging out my own eyes and begging for undeath, and that in itself is something.
Apart from there was some weird dialogue where it's all about how great he is at sex. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was odd.
There was some odd, like, he had clearly done a pass on it.
Is anyone going to say Kong Skull Island?
I did watch it again recently. It's fine. I just feel like there's about 20 characters too many in that film.
There are too many.
Yeah.
And probably a few too many monsters. Some of the secondary monsters were fun. My problem is with Kong himself. Because I love the Peter Jackson one. I think he has so much personality and charisma for like a big CG gorilla in that film. And I think in Skull Island, Kong is just a bit... you don't really feel anything for him.
Yeah, I agree. I think they went back to the classic design, but it just looks weird now. It looks really, really weird. And very unnatural in a strange way, even though the CG was obviously phenomenal.
He does twat things with a tree.
My favourite part of that film was Jordan... Is it Vogt Roberts? I can never remember how to say his name. Yeah. His honest review that he did. Did you see?
Yes, that was great.
Geniusly self-effacing. Really, really good. And also very accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it isn't.
He's a great guy.
Oh, Jordan, me and George, Geordie.
He's a lovely man, and he's making Metal Gear Solid next, and I'm excited about that. But yeah, I don't think Skull Island.
Are you saying this partly because you basically took a gap year with him? I mean, which was essentially your
travelled around the world.
This was the most extraordinary jolly. It was Nick's travelogue, sponsored by Kong Skull Island. Where did you go? How many continents did you straddle? With
only
the
three. I mean, they didn't even go to Antarctica.
Hawaii, Australia, and Vietnam.
Good lord.
And I went to someone famous's birthday party, but I'm not allowed to say who.
No, you're not. That's right.
You're not allowed to say who?
He's not allowed to say who.
And I had a dance-off with...
Why are you not allowed to say who? Did you sign an embargo?
It didn't... It was made of cake, yeah. I was just asked not to.
You were asked not to?
Yeah.
All right.
That was back in the day. Maybe it's all right. Maybe I can... I don't know.
It was Tom Hiddleston. Anyway... We're all friends here. It's all good. I'm going to throw in a couple.
Sure.
Really, really, really quick. By the way, the question came from MiniDan96 on Twitter. I found it. This is what I'm trying to do. While you guys are just blundering on, I will try and find the questions. I really liked, and I didn't expect this at all, a little film called Table 19.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. It was good.
Now, yeah, I enjoyed it. See, I went in to see this film, Table 19, and I was assigned it at the last minute, and I went in like a man going to his own execution because I had just skim-read some reviews of it on Twitter, and they were poisonous. The worst thing everyone in this movie will ever be involved with, and it's got a really good cast, Anna Kendrick and Lisa Kudrow and June Squibb and Stephen Merchant and Tony Revolori and Craig Robinson, and it's about Wyatt Russell, who's very, very good in this. And it's about a lady played by Annie Kendrick. Annie, I like to call her Annie. She doesn't know that I like to call her that. Going to a wedding, and it's all very awkward. And she gets stationed on the table near the toilets with all the dregs, all the people who are like the last minute invitees, and they're stuck by the bogs. And they bond, and they have a wonderful experience. And I thought it was really fun.
Mm.
And it's really, really surprised me. So Table 19, and also there is Captain Underpants, which I saw on a plane recently and made me laugh more, I think, than any animated movie this year.
Wow.
It's really good.
Okay.
Really funny.
Hmm.
I have been railing against Nick Kroll. And two films this year he's in and he made me laugh in both. And I'm shaken to my very core. I know loads of people think he's amazing. I've always struggled to find the funny in Nick Kroll. But he's very funny in a couple of moments in The House, which is better than you might imagine.
Yeah, I watched that on a plane. It was good.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it does some interesting things. Yeah.
It's quite funny and it's quite, you know, hardcore in a weird way. And he's very funny as well in Captain Underpants. So do check that movie out as well. Right, should we move on to another question?
Yes.
Right, okay. Here comes another question. Are you ready? Are you ready for another question?
Right, yeah, just go on. Come on.
I've lost the questions.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, here we go! Which film can you see becoming your go-to film for 2017? And by that, the film that you will watch as a succor after a terrible day at the office. And you'll go, oh, I want to watch this film now and feel better about my life.
Geostorm. I genuinely don't think anything has brought me more joy this year in the cinema than the scene in Geostorm in which Gerard Butler and Jim Sturgis, who are both playing Americans, I think.
Allegedly, yes.
They have a conversation. Gerard Butler's in space, Jim Sturgis is on Earth, and they have a conversation, and then Jim Sturgis goes, hang on, and he replays it on a video screen, but he takes out some of the words.
Oh, that's right. That is the greatest scene.
It's a code-breaking scene.
Yes.
And it's glorious.
His brother, Jerry Butler, because Jerry Butler is so super smart that he can communicate to his brother in a code that only his brother will understand. And his brother then gets someone to really to edit out different words, leaving only the key words of Jerry's message. It is an extraordinary scene. How the hell was that not your guilty pleasure?
Hours will seem like days.
Guilty pleasure, greatest movie. Go-to movie, all of the categories, really.
This is a Geostorm, this is a review of the year 2017, but it's also going to double as a Geostorm spoiler special.
Forensic detail.
Really, is Geostorm the movie that you're gonna sit down and watch and...
No.
And cuddle up with on the sofa?
Absolutely not.
Brawl in Cell Block 99.
I think maybe my serious answer is probably Baby Driver. I've watched that 6 times now.
You're kidding me.
I really like it.
6 times?
6 times I've seen it, yeah.
6 times?
Yeah.
What a year for you. You've been to Hiddleston's party.
That was last year. Oh. But, yeah.
Oh, did he not invite you back this year?
No.
Oh, man. Point. What did you do?
That's the part we definitely...
Yeah, all the cake.
Baby Driver.
It's probably going to be one of the funnier, less challenging superhero-y movies like Wonder Woman or Spider-Man Homecoming or Lego Batman for me. I will probably go back to those most often. Or John Wick 2. I mean, I've been back to John Wick like a lot. Like sometimes you just come home and you're like, I want to watch somebody shoot people in the head. And, you know, who else do you turn to?
Helen, I feel that we're really bonding on this podcast. We have much more in common than I ever dreamed.
I'm slightly nervous, this podcast. I'm turning to a gun-fu
I mean,
frenzy.
I'm going to say Thor's got to be one of Chris's, and I only say this because you've already seen it more times than I will ever see it for the rest of my life.
I haven't seen it as many times as Nick has seen Baby Driver.
Really?
6 times.
Correct yourself.
You saw Thor 6 times, didn't you?
No, I've seen four times. Four Ragnarok. And
okay.
I should also say that two of those were for work. One of those was for Q&A, where I was supposed to do a Taika Waititi. And the fourth one, we went with my my drinking game buddy, my wife. I haven't seen it for fun since.
Mm. I don't think I've seen anything more than 4 times this year.
So Wonder Woman 4 times.
One.
Again,
yeah,
a lot of that was for work. Yeah, four is my maximum, I think, this year. Yeah,
I think comedies are more rewatchable. I've seen Dunkirk twice, both at first thing in the morning, because the press screenings were at IMAX, so you had to watch it really, really early. This was a year where you needed comedies, and I think that's why just you want to rewatch the comedies.
It's a shame that most of the comedies then just didn't live up to expectations. I mean, I think it was a pretty bad year for comedies. The House was roundly derided, and did really, really badly at the box office, but I quite enjoyed it. Helen, I know you liked Girls Trip, but...
I didn't hate,
Girls
Trip was alright.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm waiting to see it. It's coming out soon on DVD.
Very, very soon, yeah.
And I otherwise, Baywatch was a complete write-off, a complete disaster. Jumanji, which we'll talk about in the regular podcast, is... Jumanji's quite fun. I enjoyed that. That was somewhat of a redemption for The Rock for me, but I think... You know, I'm going to try desperately to make it that it doesn't become just me saying Paddington 2 for every category, but Paddington 2 is the movie that I'm absolutely, I can just see myself curling up with that and a hot cup of cocoa and Werther's Originals and my little blanket and my euthanasia kit, and I'm just going to be, it's going to be fun. Have a fun time with a marmalade loving bear.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That question came from at misc_Annie.
Mine's Star Wars, by the way. Just throwing that out there. Obviously.
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 You're going to wrap up warm with The Last Jedi.
I am.
Okay.
Every day. Forever.
No spoilers, though. No spoilers.
None.
Okay, here's a question. MCU aside, with the collapse of the Dark Universe... Oh, this is more of a kind of exploratory question.
Mm.
Okay. MCU aside, with the collapse of the Dark Universe and Justice League underperforming, was 2017 the year when cinematic universes died, and is this a good thing?
So how many of them died?
Well, died is a strong word.
Just the DCEU hasn't died. It's just limping on eternally, as it always has done.
Yeah. This is from Ian999.
It's got one good leg, which is Wonder Woman, and then all its other limbs are...
maimed in some way.
Yeah.
It's basically the Black Knight from Holy Grail. Yeah.
It's a mere flesh wound. Yeah.
Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Come back.
I'll bite your legs off.
I've lost your cyborg movie. No, I haven't.
I mean,
even the Dark Universe is... continuing in a sense, isn't it? They're still going to do the Bride of Frankenstein.
Continuing in the sense that it's not continuing.
Yeah.
It's basically...
So hang on, so Bride of Frankenstein, the Bill Condon film is not happening.
It does not appear to be happening
really
in its current
this
form.
This isn't the death of a cinematic universe. This is the death of hubris, though, isn't it? Because there was no cinematic universe. You don't get to make one film, whack a logo on the front and say, we've launched a dark universe. It's like, especially a shit film. Do you know what I mean? It's like, no, please have some humility. Actually, you know, baby steps. Do something good, build on it. Don't just incredibly cynically say, we would really like a load of money.
Well, at least they had a nice time shooting that photograph.
Well, yes.
Actually, no, they were all done. That was all done separately. So
yeah. Probably, yeah.
Yeah, so they never even met.
Well, I mean, the Lego cinematic universe is arguably still going strong. Ninjago and Lego Batman this year. So it's not, you know, across the board. Hobbs, I believe, is still a thing that's in development for the Fast and Furious spin-off.
Not if Tyrese has anything to do with it.
Well, but he doesn't.
No, exactly.
I feel like the Lego thing, I don't know how you guys feel.
No, I'm with you.
But
I'm
I feel like it was a novelty film. I enjoyed it, but I think just pumping out more and more Lego films, it's like I've seen it done. Even Lego Batman, I felt, was diminishing returns.
You know how when someone comes out of Paddington and say they don't like it, you look at them as if they're just like basically Hitler. Like, I feel a lot the same way as someone who thinks the Lego films are dreadful. I feel like somehow I failed as a human being.
Yeah.
But I just can't enjoy them, any of them.
Yeah, I had the same experience. I caught Lego Batman on Blu-ray, and I was really looking forward to it, and I watched it. I didn't enjoy it particularly, and I felt really guilty. I was like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah,
there's some broken
I mean, there is something broken with both of you. You should be ashamed.
We're
that's
broken
right.
shells
that's correct.
Of humanity.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's... Because that's one of Warner Brothers' big franchises.
And people love it. People do love it. So it is just us.
But I mean, it felt like Ninjago, even, there wasn't that much.
Yeah, I didn't watch
excitement.
That.
Well, there weren't really very many press screenings for that. At least I wasn't invited to one, so
I don't
I'm saying
feel like it's a film people were talking about generally, or that there was much excitement.
No, but any time I heard anybody talking about it, it all seemed to be very positive, you know, so...
I did like the tagline, the ninja within you.
Yeah, that was a great tagline.
But also, it really bugged me that it was called the Lego Ninjago movie. Ninjago is an exclusively Lego property. So it's a tautology, and that just
cool.
They have to have
it's just the Ninjago movie.
But it's like Fantastic
there is
Beasts,
no non-Lego Ninjago. The crimes of famed criminal Grindelwald.
Let's not bring Grindelwald into it.
Yeah,
probably best.
That's a Grindelwald of hurt right there.
Yeah, we'll be here all day otherwise. What was the question?
It's hard to say.
Universes. I think there. I think what we've learned is that there's. I think there's going to be a bit of a retrenchment or retrenchment or whatever of the announcement of cinematic universes before you've earned them. And I think that's probably a good thing. And I think there's going to be a little bit more subtlety, I suspect, in setting them up. I would hope in future.
Indeed,
they just should have teased. You know, with The Mummy, especially. I think.
Yeah.
Don't show Prodigium. Don't show the whole of it in the first film, and don't show Jekyll and you know, you can just
Welcome
tease things.
But they didn't. Monsters.
Thank you, Chris. I like
was
idea.
It Chris or was it Russell Crowe?
He just popped in here for a second. It was so weird. Hey, Russ. Welcome to New World.
But Chris, you predicted wrongly, but I thought quite intriguingly that Tom Cruise could have been a
I'm not sure it was
character.
My prediction, but I'll take credit for it. I think I read it on the internet and it passed it off as my own theory. But
that's understandable.
Yes, that's how we get through life.
The problem that almost every tech startup has had since 2000, where something takes off and gets really big and everyone tries to reverse engineer it to try and recreate that success.
Yeah.
And, you know, the MCU obviously works extremely well and makes a lot of money, so everyone's trying to reverse engineer that, whereas actually just make great films, make superb new IPs, explore them, and if they do well, you know, and there's a foundation there, build on them.
And remember, like, Nick Fury didn't turn up until the credits of Iron Man. It wasn't interfering with the story. There was no, you know, big build-up. There was no time wasted on setup within the film.
Yeah.
And they didn't announce Avengers immediately either. And they took baby steps.
I listened to a very interesting interview with Clark Gregg on the West Wing Weekly podcast. Of course, Agent Casper, who changed his name to Coulson when, you know, because the West Wing verse and the MCU are intertwined through the character of Agent Casper. Yeah. And he was saying that, you know, he appeared in one and they were like, oh, could you just do this scene here? And then, well, oh, because you've got to go to New Mexico. And he was like, what? What for? Oh, you're in Thor as well. Yeah, you're going to love it. You know, and it all kind of, and he started to see the pieces all kind of fall into place. Mm. And he said it was quite interesting and unexpected. You know, do more of that.
Yeah. Apparently he only found out he was in Avengers when Joss Whedon told him literally before they were about to go on stage at Comic-Con. I don't know how true that is. It sounds like a great story. It's like, oh, really? We should probably talk pay now, shouldn't we? If I'm in it, if that's a done deal, then we should certainly, I mean, I want 20 points against the gross. Which is something I read in a business magazine. I don't know what it means, but it made me sound really smart.
Let me tell you, it's something that Clark Gregg didn't get for Avengers.
Hey, everybody, I think Agent Coulson is integral to this movie. I want 20%, 20% the gross. Hello? 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 All right, okay. So that's that question dealt with. Okay, here's a question from at XLeaserX, who's very funny on Twitter, and you should follow her. So, which movie were you honestly surprised you enjoyed?
I was a bit worried about Jumanji and The Greatest Showman, actually, towards the end of the year. I wasn't sure if either of them were going to be great, and I had a really good time at both. This is going up after the 20th, right? So I can say
this
that.
This is okay. Going up, yeah.
And I really, really enjoyed both, and I have now got The Greatest Showman soundtrack on repeat.
Here's the thing, so do I. It's, well, not on repeat, but it's in my head.
Yeah.
The opening number, I cannot stop humming in my head.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't necessarily love the film. But yeah,
can you give us a quick little snippet from it? Ladies and gentlemen,
I don't know the lyrics.
This is apparent.
But yeah.
I'm Hugh Jackman.
Hello.
I'm Hugh Jackman, mate.
This is my movie.
Look at me, big claws. I've got lovely claws.
That's
We haven't even mentioned Logan yet. It hasn't come up in any of these categories.
None of these categories apply to Logan, I would say. I'm going to go with Jumanji as well. I thought that was really surprising. I'm going to say a film here because I'm looking at the questions and I don't really see anywhere where this film fits in, but Colossal. Colossal is a film that there are lots of films this year that came very, very close to making my personal top 10 and just fell away. And Colossal is one of those. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally not the film I was expecting. If you don't know what it is, it's a film where Anne Hathaway plays a woman who finds that she is responsible for materialization in South Korea of a giant monster.
A kaiju. A kaiju, to be precise.
Okay, thanks, James. I know why you're here for moments like this. What's the difference?
It's bigger.
Okay, good. And instead of it being a big monster smashing things movie, and instead of it being a comedy, which the trailers presented it as, it's actually a really interesting drama about a woman going through a battle with, you could say, a drink problem, and with an abusive ex. And it takes interesting, dark turns, I think.
Really
she's fantastic.
Dark.
Mm.
Jason Sudeikis is great in this
as
well.
Best performance,
I would say. Yeah, I would say so. And it's really, really great.
I am, as we speak right now, going to retcon my top 10 list of the year and put that in it. And the reason I'm going to do it is because the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game, as you pointed out,
good
is
Lord.
Out next year. So the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game will have to come off my list and into next year's.
Three stars!
Four-star masterpiece.
At which point I can put in the equally four-star masterpiece Colossal. So that's good.
I mean, I agree with the last part.
Can I just say, if you did enjoy Colossal, the director Nacho Vigalondo, his film Time Crimes is amazing.
I've heard really good things about that. I've not seen it.
Nobody has seen it.
Well, he has, presumably.
I have seen it. We may be the only ones. But it's. I've been banging on about that for years. It's a really good time travel kind of head fuck.
That's right.
Budget movie.
It's a great time travel movie. I saw it next week.
It's very good.
My answer to this question is Split.
You didn't think you'd like it. But, you didn't think you'd like it.
Another film that just squeaked down my top 10.
Yeah, it's very good.
To be honest, I wasn't completely surprised I liked it, because by the time I saw it, I'd heard a lot of good things about it. But it was really nice to have a genuinely really good Shyamalan movie. Mm. Although I quite like The Visit.
I'm going to go with The Beguiled, actually, in this category, because I sort of went to see it because I thought it would be good. You know, in the same way that you have, you know, wholemeal bread because you think it'll be healthier a little bit. But it was hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. And Colin Farrell's brilliant in it. And he's also brilliant in The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And it is amazing to look at those two Colin Farrells next to each other and reflect that they are the same man at roughly the same age.
Either of them turn into Johnny Depp?
No, which is a good thing, because quite frankly, that is a downgrade.
Colin Farrell's so good.
He's so good.
He's got a lot of... When he came on the scene, he was denounced by many as just a pretty boy. And he's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right, he's very, very good in both of his films.
Mine would probably be God's Own Country. Because, you know, a film about northern farmers is not something one would naturally think would fall into my wheelhouse.
Even have Aaron Sorkin.
Well, do you know what I mean? Aaron Sorkin didn't write it. You know, it's set up north. It's quite rural.
There's no lightsabers.
There's very little sort of gun fu in it. But
anything north
lots.
Of Watford, and you begin to have like a panic attack.
You're not wrong. And I went to see it, and genuinely one of my favourite films of the year. It is high up on my list of top 10. I thought it was so good. And I came out and I was I felt like a better person. I felt like Phil Dissembling would have been incredibly proud of me for seeing that and liking it, given that it had a budget less than 100 million. Similarly, The Florida Project, which I think is one which I really, really loved, but
a child's eye
view of essentially a council estate near Disneyland is not necessarily something that I would normally queue to see, but I thought it was fantastic.
Phenomenal. And phenomenal performance from the girl in it, whose name is... Well, she's Mooney. Brooklyn Prince. She's fantastic.
She is. What a name.
Yeah.
What a name. I discovered yesterday that the young star of A Wrinkle in Time is called Storm Reid.
Amazing.
I mean, that's just a fantastic name.
That's how you start your acting career, is you get called Storm Reid, and then your first film is opposite freaking Oprah.
How is she not in a Fantastic Four movie?
Well, I think this is interesting, because you're going to get a lot of kids now who are going to be named after comic book characters and named after people in pop culture, aren't you?
So this Logan is Xavier.
I would say this is an X-Men influenced name. I mean, I've always said to my wife that I would love to call, if we ever had a son, I'd love to call that son Logan or Raimi. Yeah. And she says, fuck off.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's so weird. So I've settled for Carlito. Or Chewbacca as a backup.
Carlito,
I think she'll definitely go for Chewbacca. I don't think you'll have any problems there, Chris.
Carlito, Chewbacca, Anfield Hewitt. Anyway, should we get back to the question?
Sure.
Did we answer that to everyone's satisfaction?
I mean, do we even care?
Yes, we do care.
I apologise.
Life was surprisingly good as well.
I liked Life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great, because Life this year was actually not that great, but Life, the movie, was pretty good.
Life found a way.
Yeah, yeah. I was literally going to say that, yes.
Especially the last 5 minutes, which were, I kind of think the ending of that film kind of made it.
I would say it's probably the best alien movie of the year, which, given that there was an actual alien movie, is high praise indeed.
That had a good ending as well. I thought Covenant had a lot of issues. I thought the way it ended was actually kind of brilliant and really
enjoyed
ballsy.
The fact that it ended.
the flute scene was
flute scene was exceptional.
Well, that was sex scene of the year.
I think anyone who didn't see that ending coming at least 20 minutes beforehand wasn't paying any attention at all. Yeah. It was telegraphed in a way that I'd almost never seen before. It was just really,
yeah.
This is what you're doing. No, okay.
I'll do the fingering.
Fnar.
I mean, you know.
All right, here's another question. This comes from @AdamFowlerITV, who is Adam Fowler, who works for ITV. And he asks, your best and worst moments with interviewees this year would be good. They always give me the lols. Thanks, Adam.
Ooh. There are a few of these.
Had any worsts? Worsts?
I've had a couple of them.
I had a very stressful time in Will Smith's hotel room. Specifically the bathroom.
Wow.
Did you know you were there?
He wasn't there. But this was at Comic-Con.
What were you doing in Will Smith's bathroom when he wasn't there?
He had a suite at the Hard Rock Cafe, and I was going over to interview him and the rest of the Bright cast.
Yes.
And the guy in the lobby, I said, "I'm here for Will Smith." And the guy just went, "Yep," and took me straight up to his room. Didn't ask any more questions. So I went up. And then they were doing a quick photo shoot, but there was nowhere to do the interview. So I was panicking, and I was running around. And the only place I could do it, somebody suggested I do it on the bed. Like, we all lie down on the bed and do the interview.
I said,
"No, I'm not going to do that." So I panicked, and I thought the bathroom is the only place where we can do it. And it was incredibly stressful because there was a TV that I couldn't turn off.
This is classic discernment.
We're trying to find the remote control.
Or either of you using the toilet while this interview happened?
No.
Kill two birds with one stone?
No.
Okay.
No, there was no... So it was probably the most stressed out I've been this year.
Where were people sitting?
I had to find chairs and take them into the park. It worked out okay, but it was unusual.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I mean, in terms of bad ones, I mean, I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, my Donald Gleeson Last Jedi interview was pretty excruciating.
Oh, yeah.
It was, we're 13 minutes in, and he'd been so frosty and so difficult. And I couldn't work out why he was being so difficult and so, like, hostile. And then I mentioned something about the Last Jedi feature, and he just went, "Oh, man, I'm really sorry. I've made a complete balls of this. I've been waiting for you to ask about Winnie the Pooh. You know, I just thought you'd been a cheeky fucker asking about Star Wars." He thought it was a goodbye Christopher Robin interview. And after that, he was lovely. But that was most of the interview, just him going, "No, yes, no, no."
Yeah. Hey, he was good in Goodbye Christopher Robin. That's a movie that I thought was going to be dreadful. Actually, that's one I was really surprised by, because I thought it was going to be completely saccharine and awful. And it's actually really hard-edged, that film, while still being, you know, another cosy British author biopic. But it's much better than you think it's going to be. My best interview of the year, actually, James was there as well. And it was Keanu Reeves for John Wick 2, which was absolutely phenomenal. Now, I've talked about this before, but Keanu Reeves is the person who, I don't know why, star strikes me the most.
Yeah.
Like, completely starstruck. And this time, at least, I was braced for it. I'd interviewed him before at this point. I was prepared. I was armoured. I was able to hold it together during the interview, I think, mostly. I don't really know. But he still got it. Like, I don't know what it is, if it's charisma, if it's just the fact that I fancied him when I was 13. I don't know. But
you don't know.
I can't tell, but he's amazing.
I mean,
I'm not saying I'd say no, but I'm just saying, like, it's not like it was when I was 13.
That's fair. He's disgustingly handsome. I did John Cena recently for, I think, last week, wasn't it, for Ferdinand. I really enjoyed that interview, but there was one part, and I don't know if I made it into the interview, there's one bit where I'm talking about, like, oh, yeah, I really like The Ultimate Warrior, and I stopped watching wrestling in 1991.
Oh, it made it in.
And you can't, obviously you won't hear this, but he just stopped talking and just gave me this incredibly flat, steely, kind of flinty look. And I was like, okay, no, you probably hear me.
You get that.
You hear me like verbally reversing course and trying to realign.
This is because you are pathologically incapable of telling people lies, I think, during interviews. It harkened back for me to an amazing moment when we had Gillian Anderson on the podcast.
No!
Right back in the early days of the podcast, we had Gillian Anderson come into our booth and she was promoting The Fall, the first series of The Fall. And Jimbo here, who has no filter, went, "So I watched your TV show, The Fall, Gillian, and it surprised me, because it's actually quite good." Inference being, everything you've done since X-Files is shit.
See, the worst part of that wasn't even that. It was when I then brought up Slash Fiction, X-Files Slash Fiction,
God.
And she shut me down, and completely oblivious, I pressed on with it twice, she continued, and then in the end she just gave up and talked about it, but clearly didn't want to. I was like, a bit with Skinner and Krycek, and
it should be said, she was absolutely lovely. Like, she was one of the nicest people, that was a few years
ago. And she hugged us at the end
of it.
But
she turned up, she just came in a taxi, took us to Starbucks, bought us coffee. Yeah, and then when we did the podcast, we tried to wrap it up, and she went, "You got somewhere to be?" And then carried on.
Yeah, no, and we did it for another half an hour.
So but, she's
and
great.
Then the other part of this, which I don't think we've ever mentioned on here, is the podcast booth was very small and very cold when we got in. So we turned the heat up, and by the end, it was A, a sweat box, and B, there was a very pungent kind of body odor smell in the room, and it was incredibly overpowering.
It wasn't Gillian.
And then there was hugging at the end, and it was like, "Oh God, I don't want to hug you, this isn't good.
I'm blaming two costumes for all of it.
It was definitely you.
This year, we do a kind of series in the magazine where we get directors together. So we ask one director, which other director would you most like to talk to? And this year we got together Paul Feig. He picked Richard Curtis because he loves Love Actually. And so we got them together in LA, and they had never met before. And it was just really lovely kind of seeing them just chatting and cool. Making plans to hang out. And so that was nice. So, felt like I should have got a cut. some kind of matchmaking service.
I met Al Gore this year. That was very, very exciting for me.
That's pretty cool.
I felt so out of my depth in the hands of you. It was like, here's a serious, proper human, not a film person, a man who was, let's be honest, elected president, and who knows an awful lot of stuff. And I'm like, yes, the environment is good. We should save it. Oh, God, cars are bad. And,
please don't ask me to explain why any of this. I don't know.
I think I styled it out.
Well done, well done. James Mangold for Logan also I thought was really fascinating. He was good. Really good fun.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I interviewed him again for the magazine and for the viewing guide. And he started the phoner by going, Chris, haven't I fucking talked enough about this goddamn movie to you already? What else can I say about it? So that was fun.
A shout out to my brother Phil, who went out to the Mojave Desert to hang out with Dale Dye, who is the toughest man in the world. He's the guy who basically makes movie stars do press-ups. And apparently there were a few dicey moments during that. I mean, there was a moment where the photographer asked him to if he would pretend to pull the pin out of a grenade for Steve. And I mean, Dale Dye just gave him a 1,000-yard stare and basically he came very close to killing him. But yeah, he survived that. That's a great article.
That was actually a very good article. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah.
This is the year I finally interviewed Stephen King.
Well,
so, yes.
You're the biggest King fanboy, so.
What a year it was for him.
you, Chris.
He's telling his family about that. Oh my God, I was interviewed by that guy from Empire. He asked me really softball questions. It was only 15 minutes, but it was glorious because I've wanted to talk to Steve King, as he likes me to call him, for a long, long time. And who else was good this year? I didn't really have any bad experiences this year. I think you can listen to... listen, you be the judge. You can listen to all the podcast interviews we've done over the year, and if you think they were bad, then fair enough. Woody Harrelson. I got some closure this year with Woody Harrelson. Long story cut very, very short. One of my very first experiences as Empire, I've told this before in the podcast, which is why I'm telling it very fast, is I went to interview Woody Harrelson for a thing called Public Access, which is readers' questions. He was not in a good mood. It was not a nice day outside. He took exception to some of my questions and threatened to leave if the questions didn't improve. The questions didn't improve. He walked out during the interview, and I was like, oh my God, am I going to be fired? I've been in this job 3 months. I'm going to be fired. I wasn't. And this year he did his live film Lost in London, which was a film that he shot live in January with a cast including Owen Wilson and Willie Nelson and Peter Ferdinando and people like that. Really interesting technical exercise, and I did the onstage Q&A with him and his cast afterwards, and he was really, really lovely. And that was a moment of closure. We have a shot of us shaking hands afterwards.
He completely ignored me. I was there. We did on Facebook Live. This is the previous night.
Yeah,
and he came through and he went, "Hi, Chris," and shook your hand. I was like, "I'm basically invisible. I'm just the guy with the camera."
You get your closure in 10 years.
That's right.
There
so
you go.
This was my public access moment. So yeah, I need to get that.
This wasn't really. I think mine were okay this year. The worst things I had were sort of phone interviews with a slight delay on the line. So you've there's no chance to build up a rhythm or any kind of.
Oh, sorry, you go on.
Yep, but nope. No, I'm sorry. Had you finished?
Final question, please.
those were awful. But I was at a junket with a journalist who will remain nameless. We were doing roundtable interviews, and
Jeff.
A journalist fell asleep during a round table.
No.
Yes.
That's glorious.
I mean, we're not talking like a press conference here. There's about 6 journalists in the room. We're literally round a large conference table with several people who were talking us through the technical aspects of this film. And this journalist visibly, obviously, fell asleep.
Ah, that's bad.
That was not good.
That's nearly as bad as my Ben Mendelsohn story. So I went to Cannes, and this was a while back. This was Killing Them Softly was coming out. So, yeah, he was there for Killing Them Softly, and there was a round table with a bunch of journalists sitting around the table. And Ben Mendelsohn had arrived early, so the publicist hadn't kind of started it. So he just kind of sat down at the table, was waiting with everyone else. And then a journalist came in and was basically like, "Does anyone know anything about Ben Mendelsohn?" And started talking about him. It was awful.
did he say, oh, yeah, mate?
And then there was a point where they were like, right, if you guys want to start. And I think he must have.
Oh, my God. I remembered my worst. And it wasn't bad in that the interview was actually lovely, but it was David Lowery for A Ghost Story. And I had a horrible cold. I mean, just the worst cold. Even worse than the one you could hear a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. Laid me out for a couple of weeks, actually. And there's a moment, I actually thought about including this in the interview when we did it. There's a moment where I have a coughing fit that lasts for 3 minutes. And he's in the middle of a really, really long answer. He's a great guy, really verbose, really articulate. And he was giving this fantastic answer. And you know, you can feel the cough coming. You can just feel it tickling in the back of your throat. And you're going, oh, God, I'm going to go. But I can't. I've got to wait for him. And so he finished his answer. And the second he finished his answer, I went to the point where I couldn't speak anymore. I came up for breath.
Oh, I'd love it if that had happened in Frost Nixon.
It was so bad. I was just going, I'm really sorry. And he's just sitting there bemused going, no, it's quite all right. I had the cold last week. It's fine. Go ahead. And I'm going, oh, God. And literally, and then I try to get myself under control, and I go, anyway, the next question is, and then I just start again, and I'm taking water, and he's just sitting there with his arms folded going, okay, go on, die on me, motherfucker.
I know all about ghosts, so.
I became a sheet with eyes right in front of him. I included that at the end of this as a little added bonus.
I did Damon Lindelof for The Leftovers this year. Anyone who hasn't seen The Leftovers should do, but essentially the premise, if you haven't seen it, is like a portion of the world's population just vanishes. They depart. No one knows where they've gone, and the world kind of goes on without them. And we did a massive talk about the entire show right the way up to the finale, the final question of the interview, and Damon had been fantastic. I asked him to explain the final scene, to talk about the very ending of the show. And he starts talking about it, and then into his third sentence, he just goes, like he departs, essentially vanishes, and I can't get him back. Like the line's gone dead, I can't get hold of him. This is a phone where I should have mentioned that.
Yeah,
evaporate in the room. That would have been.
You should have led with this story. Yeah. The rapture.
It wasn't the rapture. No, we were on the phone. I lost him, and I spent nearly 40 minutes trying to get him back. Trying to get him back on the phone. It was incredibly hard. I thought, you know, it was the last question. He's probably just gone off doing other things. But bless him, he did hang around and he did call me back eventually. And when we got there, he was like, man, I literally talked for 10 minutes.
Oh, no.
I opened up about the ending of the show in detail I never have done before. And he goes, I can think of nothing more appropriate than the fact that you departed one sentence into it.
He's still seeking closure.
He's still, so we never got it. He desperately tried to recap what he said, but he was like, it's gone. It was there and it's vanished.
Disaster.
Phone's out.
That's the universe trying to tell us something. All right, very, very quickly, we've got two last questions. They're kind of linked, and then we'll get on to our top 20 of the year. So this is the best score of the year, and then someone else asked, favourite use of a John Denver song this year? So the best score?
Blade Runner. It's got to be Blade Runner.
Blade Runner was good.
It was very good. It was very good. I really, really love that. I think he did a fantastic job.
It's good, but it's not the soundtrack to the original Blade Runner, which is one of the greatest scores. I know it's not fair to compare it, but it's very hard not to.
But then you're right, and for the same reason, I'm not going to, you know, wax lyrical about the Last Jedi score, which, although good, is not classic John Williams. So I suppose if that's, you know, fair, then so is this.
Questions comes from at Word of Mayo about the score and the
comes from
John
Denver. Hans underscore Zimmer at
Word of Mayo, who I presume is friends of Word of Kermode as well. And I feel like I'm about to go David Lowery style. My voice has suddenly got quite husky. And Lanky Marlin asked the question about John Denver.
So which were the three John Denvers?
At least there were five. There were
five.
There's Free Fire. There's Free Fire in that. There's Kingsman. There's Alien Covenant. There's Logan Lucky. And there's one other I'm forgetting, but there were five.
Oh, God, yeah.
And Country
right.
Roads was at least there, three of them.
Things to do in John Denver when you're dead.
Ew, wrong, no.
Just logistically, that anyway.
I think my favourite use was probably Free Fire. which is I won't talk about it because it's quite spoilerific, but it's quite a funny use of a quite maudlin song. I think my favourite score this year, I'm going to say La La Land, because I love that. Because technically for us, I know Americans are listening to this going, what?
Can we call that a score, though?
Yeah, of course we can call it a score.
Yeah, it's a score as well.
Really?
Yes, we can.
Oh, all right, fine.
All right, so it's done. It's done.
So what are the other ones that we have that they had last year?
Manchester by the Sea, yeah. Moonlight. That's pretty much those three.
Yeah,
really.
Okay, fine.
Are we counting soundtracks that pre-existing music? Because obviously...
Sure.
Baby Driver had an excellent use of music.
Yeah, it really did, yeah.
And I'd say my favourite's probably the Hocus Pocus by Focus moment where it's the foot chase.
That's great.
Yeah, that is good.
Yeah. I'm going to give a shout-out then to Guardians 2, which I think had a terrific soundtrack and used it very well. The Mr. Blue Sky opening to that film is one of my favourite moments of the year.
Magnificent.
Should we move on?
Let's move on.
Yeah, let's move
on. All right. We have a few other questions, but we won't have time to get to them, sadly. But but do know that we read your question and we judged it. So
and ran out of time.
And we ran out of time.
It was found wanting.
So what we're going to do now is we're going to go through the Empire movies of the year. So what we do is we all submit our top tens of the year, and then Nick here assigns a very very simple point system to them. Okay, so your number one film of the year gets 10 points, your number 10 film of the year gets 1 point, and so on, and then he counts them all up.
That would have been a good way to do it.
That's a great way to do it, instead of pulling the names out of a hat, which is what you actually do. Because someone asked me how Get Out was Empire's film of the year when we only gave it 4 stars.
I said Get Out.
Many, including myself, would have given it 5, but we gave it 4. And I think over time as well, lots of people saw it, maybe they didn't see it at the time, who knows. And so a lot of people voted for it in the top 10, very, very high up. It was my number 2. So
I hadn't seen it when I voted.
But let's get to that. We'll get to that sec. But we're going to go backwards through the top 20 of the year. And we're going to start with Mother. Darren Aronofsky's...
Mother?
Not Mother. So what do we think of this? Do we think it deserves this place in the top 20? Helen is laughing because Helen thinks we should have done a spoiler special for this.
I really, really, really wanted a spoiler special for this, like so, so badly. Because it just made me laugh more than any other film this year. And not because it's a comedy. It is extraordinarily ambitious. So in that case, in that sense, like super well done. You go, guys. But it is completely demented. And its ambition is so sort of overweening that I just can't process it. And it's hard to argue with it being on this list, but it's equally just mad that it's one of the best films of the year. So I'm sort of delighted and appalled simultaneously, which I think is the correct response to anything to do with Mother. So, yeah.
Yeah, seems fair. Seems fair. What do we think of Mother, guys?
I haven't seen it, and I almost certainly never will.
Why?
It doesn't appeal to me, and on any level.
He wouldn't like the baby bit.
No, I just think there's lots in it that would upset me, and I saw everyone's faces when they came out of the first screening and thought, not for me.
Somebody suggested that maybe Darren Aronofsky's had a really terrible house party at some point. I had, because it's just people coming in a house and like breaking stuff and stressing out the guy who owns the house and the lady who owns the house.
Yeah.
And I found it, I'm kind of glad it got made because it's so weird, but
yeah,
I found it incredibly stressful and I don't think I'll watch it again, to be honest.
All right, fair enough. So that's Mother, and then at 20. So a lot of people liked it. 19. This one surprised me, actually. This is on the list. The Lost City of Sed. And yes, I'm going to say Sed because it's about British people and they say Sed, not see. Said. This is James Gray's movie about Percy Fawcett, played by Charlie Hunnam, and his doomed expedition. It's historical, not a spoiler. To find a lost city. Are you surprised by that? I'm surprised by this being on it because I didn't think that many people had seen it or connected with it.
Yeah, well, the people who did connect with it really did. You know, someone like Robbie Collin at The Telegraph, I know it was his film of his lifetime, I think, never mind the year. But it is very thoughtful and it avoids the easy sort of answers that you might expect of a film like this. And it is a pretty good, I think, portrayal of obsession and yeah, just that drive to know and to find out and to prove other people wrong, which can lead to greatness or, in this case, complete disaster. Mm-hmm. Great performances, not just from Hunnam, but also from the likes of Robert Pattinson and Tom Holland as well, right? So, you know, good cast all around. But, it's just so unexpected.
Well, this was an odd one. I seem to recall from the voting, it wasn't so much that lots of people voted for this, but the people who did put it very, very high indeed.
That does not surprise me. Yeah.
So I think the few people, because it is underseen, I think those who have seen it really did like it.
It's just arrived on Amazon Instant Video.
There you go. There's a plug for Amazon Instant Video.
There we go.
If you have it, watch it.
Other streaming and download services are available.
But don't have.
But don't have this.
The Lost City of Zed.
You can watch The Lost City of B.
It was interesting because we also got this year, we got Jungle, which was the Daniel Radcliffe film.
And Jungle is massive.
In which a British actor. I'd argue that's not necessarily the case. But this is the better film, I would say.
I don't think that's
a controversial
film. No, it's not controversial. I review Jungle. It's definitely not controversial. Daniel Radcliffe is excellent in Jungle. Jungle is not excellent for Daniel Radcliffe.
Wow. And this is definitely the best Charlie Hunnam performance of the year.
What were the other
King
ones?
Arthur, Legend of the
Sword.
That was this year.
Actually, do you know what? That's one of my top scores of the year. It's a really phenomenal score.
Number 18 on the list, The Florida Project.
Yes.
Yeah, brilliant.
Very, very, very good film. Although, again, slightly polarising. I think some people did not enjoy it, shall we say, in the office. I thought it was magnificent.
Right. It's great.
It is. It's fantastic. I think if I were to level any criticism at it, is that, and I don't even know if it's a criticism, I think it to some extent lacks the courage of its convictions, where it starts as an entirely child's eye view of a scenario, and as the film progresses, your point of view shifts away from Mooney and more onto her mother. I think that's necessary, because I think you can't explore certain themes from the child's point of view, and I think you get echoes of it without ruining the film. There are very certain themes which are deliberately child's eye view, so you don't understand what's happening until quite late on. And you're like, ooh, and that's quite shocking. But it's not purely from that point of view. But I genuinely love this. Performance is magnificent.
Sean Baker absolutely delivering on the performance of on the promise of Tangerine even more so this time. I think it's a phenomenal, phenomenal film.
Willem Dafoe again, really, really good in this.
Great, yeah,
got lovely, lovely character.
Golden Globe nomination the other day. Hopefully he gets nominations at some more serious award shows soon.
Indeed. Okay, so that's The Florida Project, which is fantastic. We gave it 5, didn't we? 5?
I think I did.
You did.
Okay. Helen gave it lots of stars.
Lots and lots of stars.
Some of the stars from Helen's Molly's Game review probably got misplaced.
Nope.
And probably need to be moved back.
Nuh-uh.
If you want to hear James and Helen arguing about Molly's Game, by the way, which I think you can, because it's not embargoed, I'm guessing,
yes,
I hope.
You can. Embargoes be damned.
Listen to the podcast that went out on December 15th, which weirdly hasn't yet been recorded. But I know they're going to argue. So it's going to be fun. All right. What are we at? Number 17. Am I right? Yeah, number 17, Assassin's Creed. Now, I'm a bit surprised by this one.
I think you're reading it wrong, Chris.
Sorry. Raw.
Yeah.
What is it good for?
SmackDown. Try some John Cena humour there for you. This is vegetarian biopic Raw.
Yes. This is the French coming-of-age movie about a young girl who discovers a taste for flesh. And I would throw this in as well with another foreign language movie, coming of age movie called Thelma, which I think got overlooked by quite a few people, and it's about a young girl who discovers that she has telekinetic powers, and as she begins to fall in love with another young lady, those powers blossom, and not always for good. Both of these are really, really great, and this one is particularly gory, particularly raw. I thought it was an average year for horror, but that was a very, very good entry. Number 16, and this may be surprising. It's good it's in the top 20. I'm surprised it actually didn't make the top 10. Baby Driver.
Yeah, I'm surprised it isn't in the top 10 as well. Astonishing editing, soundtrack, as we've already discussed. Really good performances. And just so unlike anything we've seen this year, which I think is a good thing.
Is it wrong that I'm disappointed Edgar's making a Baby Driver 2? Like, I feel this is a perfect standalone, not experimental, but just bold, original movie, and I feel that somehow that could be lessened by trying to duplicate.
But maybe he'll do something, I think, not even a maybe, he will do something clever with it and something different, I think, so we'll be okay.
It's very kind of tonally confident, and he's moved away from comedy. It's still got lots of funny stuff in it, but it's also got very good dramatic stuff in it, I'd say. And I really like the last 25 minutes when it kind of kicks into when John Hamm goes bad, breaks bad.
Number 15, Manchester by the Sea. Now, this, of course, is the first of the holdovers because we get the Oscar films by and large in January and February, which is why our list has things like La La Land and Manchester by the Sea on it. This film absolutely destroyed me.
100%. My like weaknesses are men in plaid trying to control their feelings. people who blame themselves more than the world ever could, and parent-child death issues. So I was
gone. Holy shit.
This is the trifecta right here. I was a complete mess in this film. It is a phenomenal film. No matter what you've heard, it will still, I think, hit you right in the gut.
The scene between Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams, is just an extraordinary piece of acting and repressed emotion and devastation and guilt and blame and all those things, and it's absolutely
that made me
absolutely incredible.
That was one of the scenes that made me cry.
Really,
it's an amazing scene, and she's not in the film that much, but that scene alone is astonishing.
Yeah,
so
for both of them, but especially
so good. And number 14, it's a slightly different film, is War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, indeed. The final part of the trilogy. Which is very disappointing, because I thought this would be an ongoing... I mean, talk about universes, but I thought this would be an ongoing thing. And so I was disappointed to feel that this is just three and done. But I really liked War for the Planet of the Apes. It was not so much with the war in it, but there was a lot of emotional punch to it. It looked incredible. And if anything demonstrates the state of the visual art at this point in time, it is that film.
And it had poo flinging.
It did have poo flinging. And I think really any film is significantly improved by that.
Is it, but?
Yeah.
If you have any poo, fling it now.
I liked it very much. I didn't love it quite as much as some other people, to be honest.
Yeah, nor did I.
Nor did I.
I wasn't.
It wasn't in my top 10 list.
It didn't feel as satisfying all of you. Trilogy kappa to me.
They're apes.
The librarian would be proud, Helen.
Weirdly, I'm going to completely contradict myself. I thought it was the best of the trilogy, but it still wasn't anywhere near my top 10.
I agree that it's the best of the trilogy, and I think it is excellent, and you are all idiots.
Good. Excellent.
Well,
that's
great debate there.
Glad we've settled on that one. Number 13, Unlucky for Some. And this is a movie I think would have been much higher had more people seen it at the time of voting.
Amen.
Paddington 2.
Assassin's Creed.
Assassin's Creed for everything. Paddington 2.
Paddington 2 is slightly like my Hunt for the Wilder People of this year, in the sense that I have recommended it to everyone I've spoken to, I think, since I saw it. Like, people in shops, like everybody. And no one has complained that they didn't like it as a result. I think it genuinely just seems to cross the board, and it is so, like, industrial levels of charming that I just don't understand who wouldn't like it.
It is extraordinary. I think at the time when we did the voting, only a handful of us had seen it.
Yeah.
But I think most of those who did see it put it on their list. And it went to number one for me. And I had a debate with someone in the office as well about, do you put a film on at number one because of your emotional response to it? Or do you put a film that is seen as, quote unquote, a better, more important film at number one?
Nah.
I went, no. I'm going emotional. Paddington 2 made me feel like no movie has since probably the first Paddington, and I had to put it at number one.
If it's a quote-unquote emotional film that makes you have that emotional response to something like Moonlight, which we'll get to, 100%.
Spoiler.
But you mentioned La La Land a minute ago. How am I spoiling anything?
Spoiler.
Anyway. but yeah, it's not just about, it can't just be about technical merit. These are not technical awards. Mm. So...
Yeah, it's tricky because you have to try and walk a line. Wait.
Also, it has technical merit. It has. That's how it makes us feel these things.
Yeah, so. It's incredible. But your top 10 should be what you feel is right, not what you feel other people might be judging you on.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Paddington 2, which I think is fantastic. And you know, if more people had seen it, I'm sure it would have been in the top 10. Number 12, Thor Ragnarok.
Whee!
Yes. Love a bit of Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Love this film. Marvel, and we disagreed a little on this, Marvel's first outright comedy. Flat-out comedy. This is a comedy. It's not an action film with comedy in it. It's a comedy.
Hello, I'm just getting a phone call. It's from Ant-Man, and Ant-Man says, hello, how's it going?
And I'd say, Ant-Man, you were great as a drama with lots of comedy in it.
A drama?
What?
Well, absolutely. Okay, drama's not the right word, but you know what I mean? It's an action film with more comedic elements than most
of the other MCU film.
I feel like you're getting
a comedy.
I feel like you're getting yourself in, tying yourself in knots just by trying to claim that this is the first. Like, if you just claim it's the funniest, like, no one's going to argue with you. But if you say first, then we all have to argue with you because you're wrong.
No, I'm not. It's fine. It's
Incredible
right. Anyway,
Hulk was hilarious, mostly unintentionally.
I think we can all agree, though, that it's very, very good.
Yes,
it is very good, and a huge. A lovely, refreshing surprise for me at the end. I thought it was a pretty good year for comic book movies.
I thought so too, with a couple of exceptions.
Is it though?
Well, there all was right. Okay. So,
there was Justice League, which was the...
Justice League is the outlier. Otherwise, you have Guardians 2, you have Spider-Man Homecoming.
Which was not great.
Yes, it was.
I didn't love Guardians, but he's right.
Film.
Otherwise, you've got
Guardians
Logan,
2.
Wonder Woman,
yeah.
Logan, Spider-Man Homecoming,
yeah. Stepping outside the superhero genre, you have Wilson, you have Atomic Blonde.
Defoe Stalin.
Defoe Stalin, he's absolutely right.
I take it back, you're absolutely right. However, I do stand by the fact that Guardians 2, while I enjoyed it and has amazing moments in it, is not one of Marvel's stronger films.
I would agree with you.
Mm. I also agree.
Holy shit, I've been out of photo, guys.
You've been grooted.
Let me just rejig my top 10.
It was fine. It's just, I haven't really thought about it since I left. I thought it was okay.
Well, we're not going to be talking about it because none of you fuckers voted for it. It's not in the top 20.
That's right.
I'd say it had too big an ego.
Hey.
really the problem with that one.
Oh, that's good. All right, number 11, a film I love as well, The Big Sick.
Yeah.
Yes.
Super charming film.
So good.
That should have been higher.
It should have been higher. Genuinely. That was my second favourite comedy of the year. After Thor Ragnarok, which is Marvel's first comedy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really made me laugh.
I also
really enjoyed the thing that you did in the magazine
with
Kumail and his wife, just going through the what's true, what's not stuff.
Yeah.
Because obviously it is sort of semi-autobiographical.
Yeah, it is.
Really, really charming film. Just lovely. Holly Hunter, fantastic in it as well.
Yeah. It's a comedy with the emphasis heavily on the coma. It's a comedy.
It's
such a good movie. I can't wait to see it again. It's coming out very, very soon on DVD and Blu-ray. Don't ask me when. But yeah, that's great. And for me, that's a top 10 film. Now we're into this top 10. And this is a top 10 I'm very, very happy with. I think this is great. This is very Empire, this top 10. It is a broad church. You have blockbusters. You have indie movies. You have art house stuff. You have... what else do you have? You have Assassin's Creed, obviously. Right, so number 10. Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, phenomenal film. Just gorgeously moving.
Yeah, this is a movie that I had not seen when we were voting for it, and I haven't really considered my top 10 since, but it would certainly be lurking around the edges of it. It's one of those films, it's a bit like a ghost story for me, in that it's a film I found it very hard to get out of my mind since I saw it.
Yeah,
it's a really sensual experience. It's obviously about Timothy Chalamet, his young 17-year-old boy falling in love with Armie Hammer during a sun-kissed 6 weeks in northern Italy, and it's a really languid, really beautiful film filled with great performances. And it's one of those, if I'm honest, at the time when I watched it, and this is exactly like a ghost story for me, at a time when I watched it, I was like, it's fine, it's good, I can see, it's great, it does what it does, you know, it's interesting. Ghost story in particular, it feels like, I'm not sure how I feel about it at the time, it's a bit cold, maybe I'm not quite getting it, but afterwards, the images and certain scenes just embed themselves in your mind and you can't stop thinking about them.
It's heartbreaking.
The
final shot is stuck in my head.
Of
Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah.
And it plays this shot with the credits.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can talk about it, but it's an amazing way to end the film.
It's a fantastic scene. And the performances are so good. And it takes its sweet time getting there. And top 10. Well done for Call Me By Your Name. Ghost Story, by the way, is not in the top 10. Or indeed the top 20. But it didn't make my top 10, ultimately. It's one of those movies that just kind of bounced around a bit like Brawl in Cell Block 99, or John Wick Chapter 2, honestly, for me, or even Free Fire, Ben Whitley's Free Fire. Movies that were just on the cusp of the top 10, or Monster Calls, which came out January 1st. Such a great film.
So it did.
But it's just, you're just looking at the top 10, you're going...
Silence January 1st
Silence
as well.
Silence was Jan 8.
That nearly got on my top 10.
Really?
Yeah, I thought that was really, really impressive, actually.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, for a film to live to you that long, Monster Calls is one of the films this year that absolutely destroyed me. Yeah. January was a fantastic month because it started off with Monster Calls, Silence, Manchester by the Sea, and basically, and then Moonlight comes in February, and you're just basically getting your emotions kicked around in like the saddest month of the year.
It's super important to hydrate during January when seeing these kind of films.
Yeah, and only one of those was about a man in plaid struggling with his emotions.
I know.
All right, number nine, The Handmaiden.
This was my number one of the year.
Was it?
Really?
Gosh.
It was. I really like this film. Park Chan-wook, great Korean director. Mm-hmm. And just, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but just this brilliantly kind of tangled plot. It's based on a book that originally was set in Victorian Britain, and they've moved it to Korea, and it's about a man and a woman who are trying to basically con this rich lady into marrying the guy so that they can get her money, and it's you don't want to know much more about it than that, but it's really
this
really
is great. Without a doubt the second best story about Handmaids this year.
Second best tale, about, you might say.
The other one was about Handmaiden, which is very different. But it's got a very erotic octopus in it.
I mean, that old
that's
trope.
All you, that's all you need to know.
And if we were in the habit of naming podcasts, that would be the name of this one. So,
the Erotic Octopus.
The Erotic Octopus.
There we go. But yeah, it's very kind of Tarantino-y in a way. It's it's a good film. Go
it's
see
a great
it.
Film.
Go
yeah.
see it.
Yeah.
Hey, you know where it's available, Nick? Do you know where it's available? Do you know where people can see it right now?
Right I genuinely now. Don't.
It's an Amazon Instant
is
Video.
It
Amazon is. It's an Amazon Prime.
Other streaming
you know
services.
Other streaming services are available, but none of them have The Handmaiden.
Well, some of them might, but just on VOD rather than.
This is true.
Yeah.
Number eight, Logan.
Yay! Yes.
Love a bit of Logan.
Which bit?
All of it. Really. Especially, although weirdly, the last shot obviously being my favourite bit, which I will not discuss for those few people who've ridiculously still not seen this amazing film.
I've got claws and I'm going to use them!
Yeah, it was an unexpected musical number. amazing in colour, amazing in black and white, as it turns out.
Yeah, really beautiful.
Did you see Logan Noir, Lynn? Obviously, judging from what you just said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where did you see it?
Well, we had a screening of it.
Did we?
Yes. Were you not there?
No, I was not there.
Oh, there was. Yes, there was an Empire screening of it.
Sadly, I was up a mountain in Nepal at the time, but I did see it at...
Humble brag.
There you go.
One of the Pauline anecdotes.
Logan
I did
Noir.
See it later on Blu-ray. And it's beautiful.
It is.
But it's just a great film, and I think it takes a superhero, you know, material and then just treats it differently to anything we've seen before. It treats it with a seriousness and a weight that we're not used to seeing, which also works.
Bring,
and
bring,
I think.
Bring, bring. Sorry, I'm just getting a phone call through here. Hello? Hello? Oh, hello, Spawn. Oh, no,
wrong number.
It was Michael Jai White. He got confused.
Yeah, as I was saying. But no, I just think it's beautifully acted by the three principals. Principally, but I mean, really like
it's,
it.
It's interesting. I think there is a kind of Logan effect going on in Hollywood at the moment because it showed that you can take a big franchise and go small.
This won't work for everything. Not everything should be, you know, dark and end up with the way this ends up. But when it's done well and it's done right and it's done for the right reasons, I think it works brilliantly. Yeah. And you know, he's right. You know, not everything. We can't keep escalating the stakes. Yeah. And I think the best superheroes films right now are the ones that realise that and tailor their story to the characters. Mm. So
that's why Justice League. Yeah, I mean, because that's the main problem is they're just doing it over and over again. Like, it has to be the world blowing up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be about characters first. These are characters.
Exactly.
Stories. Spectacle is a symptom, you know, but you should...
But character is the disease?
Yeah, but character is a disease.
Cobra is the cure.
DC is the cure.
No, Cobra is the cure for everything.
I would like to point out at this point that Logan has made more money worldwide than Justice League on about, what, a third or a quarter of the budget. So, you know, it should... People will learn something from that.
And
at time of recording.
At time of recording.
Justice League may have made more money by the time you listen to this.
Number seven, as James has already expanded about this at great length, God's Own Country.
God's Own Country. This is an incredibly poignant film. It's really, really powerful. And really, one of my scenes of the year is in this. Have you seen the bath scene in this? Mm-hmm. That scene with him and his dad in the bath just destroyed me. It's so emotional. Really, really powerful. Loved it.
That's James's favourite film this year set north of Watford.
It is.
And I wonder if this is your favourite film this year set south of Watford. It's Dunkirk.
Yes.
Chris Nolan's Dunkirk. This is south of Watford, isn't it? I'm right in saying
it is, that. That is correct.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Phew.
I'm going to say
well geography.
Quite pretentious about Dunkirk, and that's that. It is two films. It is a film seen on IMAX, and it is a film seen in a standard cinematic format, and they are two different experiences. And I do genuinely believe you should watch both of them, or just watch it on IMAX, but definitely make sure that one of your Dunkirks is an IMAX experience. Mm.
I have not seen this film on IMAX.
Because this was the first time they've used handheld IMAX cameras, right?
Yes. So. And this is why, Chris, you've watched Dunkirk, but you haven't seen it.
Oh, God. Then riddle me this. How is it still in my top 10 of the year? Well, I was blown. So would I be even more blown away by it if I watched it on IMAX?
Even more impressed.
What's different? It's bigger. Ooh, well done.
Yeah, this wasn't in my top 10, I'm going to confess.
Wasn't in mine either.
It's I thought it, you know, as a spectacle, obviously it's very, very impressive. Although, you know, you could have maybe retconned some of the 1970s buildings in the background, but sure.
ships, Helen.
Those were buildings, Chris. Some fantastic elements to it. I find the timey-wimey stuff frustrating and not as effective as I thought it should have been.
Mainly because it didn't. Actually,
it wasn't a week.
It didn't. Yeah, it was wrong. Like, the chronology is all over the place.
You know, he tried to do something with that, and I didn't like it.
My issue was that he's already done that with Inception, and I think he did it better in Inception.
Yeah,
Inception.
So that's one of my. I love the Dunkirk, but that was one of my.
I love the Dunkirk. Oh, the Dunkirk!
I love
is great.
The Dunkirk.
love a Dunkirk.
Love a bit of Dunkirk.
Number five. I don't know why I did that.
I know
five,
why you did. You're looking at the picture.
Number five is The Death of Stalin. But this, because I'm doing it in this Cornish, isn't it? I don't know what I'm doing.
This was my number one, actually, of the year. I think it's a phenomenal, phenomenal film. It's hilarious, but literally all the comedy comes from the fact that they're all monsters. Mm. And the film doesn't compromise on that, and it doesn't cover that up, and I think that's really important to do if you're going to make a film like this about a real world subject and about people who have done terrible, terrible things. I think there's a tendency sometimes to accuse people of making light of, for example, the millions of victims of these men, and I don't think it does even slightly. It keeps the eye on the victims enough that doesn't happen. And I think we've both read the book it's based on, Nick, and it is a fairly serious, you know, graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And he's been fairly faithful to it while at the same time making it hilarious, which is an amazing act of alchemy. So full marks to Armando Iannucci and the entire cast, but most especially, of course, Jason Isaacs, who's just brilliant. Oh, just so good.
It's, this was like my two or three. Favourite comedy of the year by far.
Yeah.
Just so funny, but does have dark moments, like you say, and walks that line very delicately. But just watching this bunch of actors together is just amazing. Having Michael Palin in there, Paul Whitehouse. It's like an incredible ensemble cast, but yeah, I've seen it a few times.
Simon Russell Beale as well. My God, he's so good in it. And so terrifying.
Yeah. Very dark character. Mm. But I mean, just to have the kind of the balls to take on, do a comedy about this subject.
Yeah.
And not everybody thinks that they should have done it, but I think it works amazing.
No, I don't think they shouldn't have done it. I just didn't like it very much. I found it really oppressive and claustrophobic as a comedy, and I stopped laughing about an hour in. I get what Armando Iannucci's going for, and the performances are great, and it's very, very whip smart and brilliantly written. But, I do like to laugh at my comedies. And I felt that I didn't.
I never stopped. I think it's brilliant.
You must have been exhausted.
I mean, I didn't laugh quite as hard as I did in Mother, but...
Jesus.
Genuinely.
All right. Number four, Moonlight.
Oh, another film that will absolutely destroy you. Mm-hmm. And gorgeous performances, gorgeous cinematography as well, actually. I don't think that's been talked about enough. And just a look at, you know, loneliness and the way that damage in childhood can affect us for the rest of our lives, and the armor that we build for ourselves and the way that that can trap us as much as it protects us. It is just a stunning film, practically plot free, but you don't miss it. I just think you're so wrapped up in this one man's life, and absolutely haunting, gorgeous, wonderful film.
Hell of a year for movies about gay relationships and gay themed movies. Certainly three here in the top 10 alone. It seems to be a bit of a sea change in the attitudes. I won't say Hollywood, because obviously God's Own Country is as far removed from Hollywood as you can possibly get.
Yeah.
But certainly a sea change in maybe audiences' attitudes to movies like this, to embracing films like this. Call Me By Your Name, I know, is doing very well at the box office in terms of, you know, limited releases and whatnot.
Sure,
yeah. States, and it's going to be an Oscar front runner. So that's fascinating to see. Mm-hmm.
This also gave us, of course, the greatest moment of the year, which was Moonlight actually winning the Oscar, which was the most extraordinary thing to happen in film in a very long time,
what
genuinely.
Remind me.
You mean when La La Land's cast and crew went up on stage, having been announced as the winners of the Best Picture at the Oscars, then had to, a couple of minutes into the speeches, discovered that they hadn't won and that Moonlight had. I mean,
that's 2017 in microcosm, isn't it?
It kind of is. It was chaotic, and it must have been awful for the La La Land bunch, and they have handled it with grace and enormous dignity, I have to say, but it was just an astonishing moment for film.
Yeah,
Chris, you got to talk to Warren Beatty about that, didn't you?
I did.
On this very podcast.
I did, and I forgot to mention it in my great interview experiences of the year, because that was a lot of fun, and he was pretty awesome.
Assuming for a second I didn't listen to that podcast, what did he say?
I can't remember.
He basically didn't realise he'd been given the Best Actress.
Yeah, and just didn't know how to deal with it.
No, he opened it up, he saw La La Land in big letters. And
but he didn't read it out. He clearly sees the problem. And he looked around,
yes.
And she's the one who leans over and goes, La La Land, and he's like, no.
Yeah, people thought that he had thrown Faye Dunaway under the bus, but I think he was basically looking at her going,
she left,
what are we doing?
Look at this.
Yeah.
look at the tape.
She was driving
the bus.
She
doesn't look at him.
No,
she looks
at the card and just announces
this grin, just staring at the camera. Why are you taking so long, Warren? Oh, La La Land!
And he's like, no, God.
Basically, they were both put in a position they should never have been in by the accountants.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. As are we all at one point or another in our lives.
That's all true.
All right, so one of the year's biggest moments was Moonlight unexpectedly beating La La Land. Moonlight at number four. Number three, La La Land. Is that right? Can we just double check the count on that one, please, Nick?
It's correct.
It is correct.
It is correct.
Nick is first.
I've done all the accounting. Don't worry, guys.
Faye Dunaway has just texted me. She says, yes, it is in fact La La Land at number three.
Dunners. You've got her on your phone as Dunners. Nick, Dissemblian and Dissemblian accountants are responsible for this. La La Land is number three. Helen is overjoyed at this.
I think this is a plus key. Carry on, sorry.
The problem with La La Land is it's fantastic, and we spent the whole of January playing the soundtrack and getting excited, and now 12 months in, I'm just a bit done. Do you know what I mean? But it is fantastic. And if it had come out this month, I'd still be singing the songs.
Yeah, sure, fine, whatever.
I am still singing the songs.
Yeah, you know, it has many good bits. So
I'm glad that you're magnanimous enough to admit that after 12 months of was it the I Hate La La Land blog? If you want to go to Helen O'Hara. Do you have a website?
I should do, shouldn't I? No, I don't. It seems like an awful lot of work.
Yeah.
But okay. But it would be Helen O'Hara. .com/IHateLaLaLand, obviously.
All right, so speaking of films that wouldn't be in your top 10.
It was not in my top 10, no.
Our number two film of the year wouldn't be anywhere near my top 10. It is Blade Runner 2049.
You are a hater, aren't you? You're a
I'm not a
cold,
hater.
Heartless shell.
I'm not a hater, I'm a shrugger.
Ugh.
I'm a shrugger. This movie is
Chris
one
shrugged.
Giant shrug. Mm. Very pretty shrug.
Yeah.
Very well photographed shrug.
Big up Roger Deakins.
Yeah.
Yes. The Deke was on fine form.
He was.
But then I'm not a fan of Blade Runner. So, yeah. Still Spider-Man Homecoming, isn't it?
I appreciate the original Blade Runner. I appreciate many things, although not all things about this. Don't love either, and really didn't love this. So.
Wow.
All right. Okay, people who love the film, defend it. Go.
Yeah.
Go. Why is Blade Runner 2049, which is a movie I know people have freaked out over, on number two on our list?
I enjoy the colour orange.
Well done. Okay, number one.
It's got a lot of great stuff in it.
It's a mood piece, though. It's not a narratively driven film. It
I'd argue
sounds
there's too
beautiful.
Much plot.
Too much plot,
really?
Yeah, I'd agree.
Too much plot in it, definitely.
I
that's
didn't
one of its
feel
pro-
that
that's one of its problems. It's
Did you find
plotty.
It hard to follow?
It's too plotty.
It is hard.
Of course it's hard to follow.
For me, it was more... I must admit, I didn't find it hard to follow at all. I really enjoyed just the sense of place, the sense of being, the sense of time. You know, I really found myself just inhabiting that movie throughout the duration of it. And I liked that it was ponderous, and I liked that it was slow. And it obviously helped that we saw it in that glorious IMAX screen. I'm not on commission.
I think it could have been.
No, but it does look great. It's never going to look better.
Is brought to you by Amazon Video and IMAX Cinemas. I mean, it's just a stunning experience. I came out and just thought that was just amazing. Plot-wise, really, I was kind of... I mean, the plot, I followed it fine. I was a little indifferent to it. I almost think that almost wasn't what I wanted from it or what I got from the film.
Yeah, that's because there's too much plot.
Yeah, they did. Robin Wright's character did not need to be in the film. I thought that was...
Robin Wright needs to be in every film, but yes, I see what you're saying.
You know, the character of Love, I thought, was a bit of a generic martial arts fighting villainess. I don't know. I there were bits of it I didn't love, but there are some amazing sequences. I think the scene where he goes back and has his baseline test.
Oh, Interlink.
It's one of my favourite scenes of the year. Cells Interlinked.
Amazing.
I'm definitely going to watch this film a lot. I can tell.
As indeed will Chris and Helen. I think we've agreed.
Oh,
so
sure.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to love our Blade Runner 2049 supporter special, which we are doing. We are doing a Blade Runner 2049 supporter special because finally we got an interview with the director, Denis Villeneuve. Nick did that a few weeks ago. We're holding out for the film's DVD and Blu-ray release, which will be at the end of January. Haven't recorded it yet. So who knows? Maybe I'll watch it again for that and maybe I will love it. My opinions would be transformed.
Could be.
Let's hope.
Maybe in 30 years' time I will love it. Who knows? Who knows? But there you go. Number two film of the year is Blade Runner 2049, and number one film of the year, Get Out.
See, interestingly, you said you didn't think it's been much of a year for horror. And yet, a horror film is our number one film of the year.
Mm. There hasn't been the number of some of recent years. You know, It Follows, The Babadooks, Girl Walked Home Alone.
Well, Comes at Night got a lot of buzz, didn't it? Like, lots of people were bigging that up. I must admit, I was a little underwhelmed by that.
We did have it.
It's lots of it. It Comes at Night.
Huge. It made a lot of money for a horror film.
Mm.
And I'm really excited to see the cast in the next one. But we had Raw, which is a horror film.
Yeah.
I think it's been a great year for
Annabelle Creation. Do not forget about Annabelle Creation. How could you?
How could
Life is a horror film, I'd say.
Yes, it is.
The Dark Tower, which isn't a horror film, but
it's a horror film.
It was horrifying,
Baywatch, Jesus.
And Get Out I saw very recently, so I didn't vote for it, but I mean, it really is very, very good indeed.
Would it have been in your top 10?
It would have been in my top 10. It wouldn't have been in my top 5. It would have been in my lower 5 of the 10, but yes, I thought it was great.
I think it was 2 or 3 for me, I think.
It was my number one for a long, long time because the film blew me away. And then I saw a bear that loves marmalade and it made me cry. And I just went to number one. But Get Out is fantastic.
Out did need a marmalade eating bear.
It really did.
That would have been a shock reveal.
It would have just put it over the edge. This is a really smart film. It's a really funny film, really darkly funny film, but also quite broadly funny film at times as well, as you might expect, given Jordan Peele's comedic background. But it's a very dark film, quite scary, quite gory. Has a lot of things to say about the racial divide in America, and I thought it was absolutely terrific. And had a real blast with it. And I can't remember many debuts as assured as this stylistically.
Just the iconic images that have come out of this.
Absolutely!
For a first-time director, with the teacup, the spoon going around the teacup, the shot of him there with tears running down his face.
Mm.
The scene where the stuff where he's kind of inside that sort of weird.
The sunken place.
The sunken place.
That's what I'm looking
sunken
for.
Sunken place.
Just for a guy who's making his first film to come up with that image.
Yeah, that was astonishing. The other thing is, I watched this recently with a big audience of young people, and there's a moment where a police car draws up, and the reaction in the cinema was astonishing. And I think it's fascinating the way that the film plays with your expectations, and in fact the differing expectations of what a police car means to white people and black people. And you get to the point in the film when that car turns up that you think you know what's going to happen and you're terrified. That I think is really just effective storytelling. And also just, you know, it goes back to Roger Ebert's whole thing of cinema being an empathy machine. It absolutely puts you in his shoes and keeps you there for the entire film. And I think that's a very important thing to do, actually.
It has one of the most satisfying rampages of revenge I can remember for a while. It's a really great, great film. And Jordan Peele, you know, I think it's going to maybe not be in the Oscar conversation, which is a bit of a shame, but...
It still might be in there. I mean, it'll be in the best screenplay category at the very least, I would hope.
It'll hopefully get a nomination there, but I would say Daniel Kaluuya is really, really great in this.
He is, yeah.
And as is the entire cast. It's some of my favourite scenes of the year. There's one of the great reveals of the year. We haven't really talked about that in the podcast. The car keys sequence. I mean,
so good.
It's one of my favourite scenes of the year.
Lil Rel Howery, if I'm saying his name correctly, is one of my unsung heroes of the year. I thought he was glorious in this.
It's his best mate.
His best mate.
Yeah, he's great.
Very, very good.
His mate, Rod.
Yeah. It is a cracking film. So get out, and we'd be fascinated to see what Jordan Peele does next.
Now, something I should point out at this stage: the best films of the year list was done before.
Oh God,
The Last Jedi came out. So The Last Jedi is not on this list because none of us had been able to see it when we did it. The Last Jedi will be added to our list of the year and will have been added to it before this goes out.
And also, we made our list before the Flatliners remake.
also true. Also
and Jumanji, true. Welcome to the Jungle.
The Greatest Showman.
But if you want to see
that's going
to
topple the top 10.
Definitive final list, it will be on the website. So go and have a look.
Would it be in your top 10? Would The Last Jedi be in your top 10?
Without a shadow of a doubt, yes.
Where would it be?
It'd be at number one. Because it's Marvel's. I mean, it would be at number two, maybe after the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game. I think that's probably right.
Good Lord. It didn't even come out this year. And you're wrong.
Oh, my God. If Aaron Sorkin wrote and directed a Star Wars film, you'd be just salt, wouldn't you? You'd just be...
Kylo's Game.
Oh, it'd be amazing.
Helen, would Star Wars be in your top 10?
Do you know what? I'm not sure. For reasons that we'll get into when we discuss it a bit more, but I had a lot of issues with the storytelling in the end of the ending of the last sort of third of sixth of the film.
Yeah,
I had some issues with the storytelling, and I think that might take it out of the top 10 for me. But then again, I mean, Wonder Woman made my top 10 despite me having issues with the storytelling there at the end. So you know, it might well get in there.
Nick, would Star Wars be on your list?
It would. It would. It wouldn't be right up the top, but it would be in there. If it had more porgs, I think it would have had a shot at the number one. But I liked it very much. I'm like Helen, I had a few issues, but we will talk about that later.
We will. As for my, we'll make it to my top 10. I've just had a look at the list, guys, and let me just moving around, just recognize it. Okay. It's number 11. It's number 11. It just squeaked by.
And we are going to have a Star Wars spoiler special, are we not?
We are going to have a Star Wars The Last Jedi spoiler special.
We are.
It is out on January 15th. Whether it comes forward or not, we don't know. But at the moment, it is going to be January 15th. So do keep an appeal for that. And that is going to be with Rian Johnson, the writer and director of the film, spilling the beans on all the big revelations. Zombie Han Solo, poor Gorgy, all the stuff that you really wanted to know about. It's all in there. So I'm very, very excited about that. We're going to wrap this up. But before we do, what film, one film from all of you that is not in the top 20 of the year should be in the top 20 of the year?
James. Well, Chris, it's funny you should ask.
It's not out this year, James.
It's not out this year. That's it. No.
I'm going to say Wonder Woman, just because it probably gave me more joy than anything else not in the top 20 this year. And I thought it was really good. And I also think it's going to have a huge effect on Hollywood going forward. And hooray for that.
I'm going to say John Wick Chapter 2,
because
I loved every minute of it.
It's so good.
G.S.T.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
Just kidding. The Snowman. No, Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Oh, good call.
A film which admittedly I had to watch in chunks because I was crying.
Everyone watched that film in chunks.
Wincing my way through it, but what a film. Craig Zahler's become one of the main directors to watch, I think, and Bone Tomahawk was fantastic as well, and it's exciting. He's got another one out next year, Dragged Across Concrete, with Vince Vaughn again, and I think that's one to watch.
Very excited by that one. And yeah, I'm going to go with Wonder Woman as well. It's the only film on my top 10 list that we have not talked about, and if I'm honest, I'm surprised it wasn't in the top 20.
Yeah, me too.
But actually, when I saw the list, very few people voted for it. I think you and I were the only ones who had it quite high up as well. The last 20 minutes is not good. Everything that goes before is fantastic and made me feel like I felt when I saw Superman the movie as a kid. So there we go. That is it for our review of the year. There's loads of stuff we haven't had a chance to talk about, but don't worry, there's always next year, right?
Yeah.
Right, President Trump?
Well, let's hope so.
Right, Kim Jong-un? Got next year, right? Okay, we're all good. Everyone's good. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks, of course, to my star-studded panel of guests, James Dyer.
Goodbye.
Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Nick Desemlian.
Adios.
And it's goodbye for me as well. We are off to celebrate the new year. I hope you do too, in suitably responsible fashion. Have a great one. Thanks for listening.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody. Bye-bye.